Alright, boys and girls, here we are again. Now, as you can tell, we're going to talk about something a little esoteric, and it has to do with loving yourself. We had this funny comment from a guy, or I guess it's a guy. He's sort of poking fun in the comments, and I thought, hey, I'm glad he did it. I'm so glad he did it. I forgot the guy's name. But it was a really nice show. But you really love yourself. And if there ever was a psychosis in a statement that is built from those who want to rob you of the most amazing things in the world, it would be that statement. Has infected your brain, you know? I mentor kids from time to time, especially as their parents figure out what I know and how I approach things. We don't do conspiracies for children that much, you know? But I will never lie to a child. But one of the things that I find children in the state of is not loving themselves. And what's really strange is that after I interview the parents about that particular process, or that belief system, they have no knowledge of ever teaching their child that particular attribute, you know, don't love yourself. But consequently, I see it exuding out of the parents on accident because they learned it from somewhere. So this episode is going to be about the difference of loving yourself with confidence and keeping out of any hubris, arrogance. That is really what I think, that if we are to be the most genuine society and productive society, that's the other half of the emotions we actually want to steer away from. I think the sickest thing about the whole thing is that, just to start off with an example, is that there's a lot of people out there who have spent the majority of their life struggling to be confident. And they manage to find their confidence, and somebody takes a piss on them. Like a comment in a video or something, right? If that person's not strong enough to own their own opinion of themselves, a lot of times it's, you know, a loved one. There's a great movie out there called The Razor's Edge with Bill Murray. For those of you who think Bill Murray's cool with all the other funny stuff he's ever done, you have to see The Razor's Edge to see the best drama he's ever been in his life. He should have got an Oscar for it, hands down. Hands down. But there is a scene in that film which is almost exactly what I'm talking about right now. There's a woman in the movie. I won't ruin the film for you, but there's a woman in the movie who struggles deeply with where she ended up in life. And there's another girl who has everything handed to her on a silver platter, plus she's sort of a backstabber in many ways. So the one that's been down and out has the highest level of integrity, and the one that is rolling in the material possessions is absolutely a backstabber, and you know, she's a subject of her youth and a lack of guidance, I would say. But what ends up happening in this film is Bill Murray's character actually helps the one that's down and out gain confidence again, and really gives her a new life and teaches her how to start over from scratch. And then she starts becoming the one that has the stuff that matters in life, and the one that has all the possessions she has all the things that don't matter in life. She sees this in the other girl, and as a spiteful see you next Tuesday, she makes over and implies something that's not true, and I believe that's the way it works, and absolutely crushes the confidence of this girl, and she ends up going off and getting herself in a lot of trouble in a fatal way. And it's that whole greedy, you know, thing that led this particular one, which someone wanted to remain the haves. And as soon as they realized that they had made all the poor decisions, that they believed the hype about society and had possessions over love, right? Maybe it had alcohol over love. When they saw someone who had love, the one thing that was tough to get, they had to destroy it. They had to sabotage it. So, again, when you rate life on a bell curve, the bell that just came in that's a lot higher than yours vanishes because you killed the person who made that bell curve happen. I find a lot of that happens in life. And this particular statement from a listener is someone trying to kill my bell curve of happiness in their own mind. Yeah, no one's going to, you know, I'm not an impressionable person by any stretch of the imagination, okay? But I just hate it when I see people buy into this scam of you're not allowed to love yourself. And I think most Catholic religions definitely teach self-loathing. They teach guilt. They teach the only way to ever have a happy feeling is to be subservient to this make-believe religion that they've created. And I've never been in any other religion, so I can't really speak for the other religions. I can't even assume that the other religions have done this. But the focus, the funny thing is, the focus of me loving myself, this is how kind of sort of shallow the statement was that I smoke these. I smoke cigars, therefore I love myself. I love myself too much because I smoke cigars. Man, I don't know how you make that connection between the two, right? Like somehow I feel, I don't know, you know, to beat these up for just a split second under this notion of what we feel about ourselves and that sort of thing. You know, I smoked as a child because I had, you know, a dare from a kid when I was really young, from probably the age of 9 to maybe 10. So about a year. But I smoked Lucky Strike, Pall Mall, super long non-filters, and I smoked. I inhaled. It was gross. And then I was short of breath when I was a kid. And so one day I was literally playing hide-and-go-seek in the apartment complex, and I had this pack of Winstons on me because I'd switched over to Winstons with filters, which was really odd for me because I had non-filters for the year preceding that. It's probably about a month I had this Winston pack on me. And I ran, and I felt short of breath. And they always told me that you would feel short of breath if you smoked. And I have no idea if the cigarettes actually had caused damage within the 11 months I was smoking them. But I remember I threw the pack of cigarettes on the ground. I can still see them in my mind to this day, and I crushed them. And man, those were gold. You know, when you were a kid and you couldn't walk in and buy cigarettes, if you had someone that was going to buy them for you, it was a big deal. And so I went without smoking cigarettes. I'm just going to go off the cigarette thing real quick. At the age of, say, I think 13 or so, I was in Massachusetts, and I got this huge craving for cigarettes. I told my buddy, who was a little bit older, who would go buy cigarettes for me, to get me a pack of Pall Mall Super Longs, which you take a normal cigarette and you add a little bit more to it and you take off the filter, and that's a Pall Mall Super Long. Really intense, heavy strength, right? So I don't want to smoke. I don't want that urge on my system. So I sat underneath this crazy, it was almost like an aqueduct where all the drainage went out of this industrial area. I sat underneath this thing with my buddy, and I smoked 5 of these things in a row until I was pukey sick. I went home on my bike, I had my hand on my handlebars, and I just was like, oh, I feel horrible. And boom, I got rid of that craving. I think I've taken a puff on a cigarette maybe twice since I was 13. Okay, well, cigars. Where did I get involved with these things? Aren't these things super cancer bombs and I'm just nuts here? I'm preaching how to make your life better, but I'm smoking these things. Must be because I want to be super cool. Must be because I want to love myself, right? That just makes me want to laugh. It's just hilarious. Okay, so I helped a buddy in 2009. He had his own cigar brand. And he said, I need a website to sell these things. And it's super hard to sell cigars or any tobacco online because it's a mafia at the top. And he's right, and it still is. So, you know, I was like, okay. I went over to a smoke shop, and he's like, well, I'll buy you, any cigar that you want. I know nothing about cigars. I mean, nothing. And last time I had ever smelled anyone smoke a cigar was just sickening and gross, and I just didn't like people to smoke cigars as a child. But now I'm kind of grown up. Let's see what this is all about. And he gives me a Connecticut. And no one's telling me how to smoke this thing, right? No one is telling me don't inhale. I didn't, but I was kind of like looking at everybody else, like, what the hell do I do with this thing, you know? And it was a nice, light Connecticut. So I smoked a few. I went to a couple sales events and smoked the crap out of them. And, you know, it was okay. It was cool. I wasn't paying for them. I didn't realize how lucky that was. But I still was scared of these things. I didn't know the difference between body and strength and all this other stuff. Anyway, long story short, I got out of these, and I got back into them, and I go 6 months smoking them, 6 months not smoking them, you know? I like to smoke them on the show, I guess just because it's sort of, you know, when these gets into my blood sugar levels, it sort of meditates you a little bit. So, it's, I don't know. If somebody thinks that this is the thing that makes me cool, then they must think it makes me cool, or they must think it makes me uncool. I don't know. Weird. Maybe it's just a satirical view on things, but that's not the terribly important part. The terribly important part is that you do love yourself, and that you make efforts to love yourself, and that you allow your children to love themselves. Now, again, there's a super difference between confidence loving and arrogance loving. But here's what I think is very fascinating in this country, at least America, and I'm sure there's a remnant of this in Europe too. We have passes. that we write people so that it's okay to be arrogant. It's okay to be confident, and it's okay to love yourself. What am I talking about? I'm talking about celebrities. Celebrities, we love them because they're allowed to love themselves, and they're allowed to build up an empire of their own creation, of their own unique abilities, of their own unique style. And we say, we want you to be arrogant on stage. We want you to impress us with how cool you are. Because Mob Rules, you've been certified to us as being worthy of actually loving yourself. And no one else is but you, right? I'm going to move this camera because it looks like shit. All right, today we'll move it up a little closer because it's just, you know, I videotape these things and I have this awning thing, this, you know, a bunch of bars across the top, which I'm not actually sure what the hell the thing is for. Then I create a few weird shadows on you, make your tan look bizarre. But when my patented filter runs to make this show look a little weird, it looks a little strange. So there you go. Hopefully I can remember to cut that out of the audio part. But let's get to the root of this whole thing, shall we? How do you ride the fine line between confidence and arrogance? There is a passage in the Bible, which I think is very interesting, and I forget the guy's label, but he goes up to pray at a temple. And he goes to the front of the temple, and he stands up. He's a rich guy. And he prays to God openly. He prays out loud. And he says, you know, thank you, Lord, for giving me this, that, and the other thing. And then he crosses a line, and he says, thank you for making me unlike these guys, this guy here next to me, who's like, you know, some poor guy. Thank you for not making me like him. You know, essentially insulting this guy right in front of his face. And for me, there was nothing more arrogant in an example than that particular passage in the Bible. Like, more beautifully done. You know, it's just so, and it's supposed to be the parable to obviously tell you not to do that sort of thing. But the whole celebrity thing is interesting because I used to follow, well, tons of celebrities when I was a kid, you know. Nobody wanted to see Freddie Mercury walk on stage, you know, scared of himself. No one wanted to see David Lee Roth walk on stage scared to perform and do a backflip or the splits in midair, right? If he didn't do that, if he didn't maintain such a performance, then we would want our money back. But what happens is you get these kids online who obviously are projecting, right? The kid who said this is obviously projecting his own insecurities. He doesn't like himself, or he feels perhaps because of guilt of religion or guilt of some other kind that to love himself is a sin in the eyes of some fictitious god in space, right? That really gives a shit about what you think of yourself, right? So what, you know, because we could come at like, okay, here's confidence, here's arrogance. Both of you know the difference between confidence and arrogance. I'll put more of a finer point on it, but let's approach it from the underneath. What could you lose by being confident? What could you lose by being arrogant? That would be the only motivator to be one way over the other, right? Okay, so you're super duper confident about what you can do. Where is there any drawbacks in that? Well, you could be overconfident, right? You've actually deluded yourself a little bit. You're slightly more confident than you are capable of delivering. And that could get you into an issue. However, when you want to try something for the very first time, what quality do you think you need to have? You need extra confidence. Confidence in things you've never done. So you have to be overconfident if you're going to walk on stage and do something you've never done before. You have to. Now, you might be, you know, a very analytical person, and you say to yourself, well, I know that I can do this. I've never done it before, but I've done all the calculations in my mind. I'm the data robot in Star Trek, and I totally know I can do it. And then there's mortal human being consciousness, which is, wow, I don't know. I hope I can. Hopefully I just get on stage and things start to work out right. You know, I love that fear of the unknown, of whether or not I can pull something off. I love it. But I'll tell you what, it's a sort of a game that I play with everybody else. You know, like I sang at a wedding this year, a couple songs, and it turned into kind of a disaster because the stage wasn't set up properly and the drummer didn't know the second song. So that made me look like shit trying to sing to a song. We kind of recovered. But I'd never done that before. And I'm in a room with people who have, you know, 5 to 6 to 7 platinum albums apiece. Right? I got a guy from Quiet Riot on stage with me playing. I've got REO Speedwagon dude in the audience. I got one of my best friends from the band Rat out there. You know, I'm being judged by my friends or these associates, and I don't want to, you know, nothing worse than going up singing stuff horribly. And then there's all kinds of other people in the room who've already sang, you know, before me. I'm singing songs I'm unfamiliar with, at least one of them. So I had to go up there and do this. And I've been practicing for 2 weeks beforehand. I had barely any notice to learn a song perfectly, you know, which sounds like a lot of time, but, you know, when you're new, and I was super duper busy at the time, it was the holidays, it was just rough, but I did it. So how do I get on stage when I've never done something like that in front of these amazing people that don't fail, you know? You have to have the confidence you can pull it off. But at the moment you've never done it before, you can't quite close the deal in your brain that you have the confidence to actually do it. And so at some point, you're going to have faith in yourself. You're going to have to be able to go over the top. Now, the other big secret sauce of singing on stage, and I had these, I hung out with the guy that used to sing for Journey the week before, and he was giving me tips. And he's like, well, you know what? He goes, most of the time you sing at these events, most people are so shit-faced, they don't know the words themselves. So he goes, just, if you ever run out of words, and I had no problem with the words, but I thought I was, he said, just mumble something remotely, you know, rhyming with what you think is supposed to go in that spot. And he goes, no one will find out that you missed the words. And the critiques I got afterwards was that I finally understood the words to that song when you sang it. So I actually was able to enunciate the whole thing, right? But the amount of times I've done stuff that I've never done before is huge. I do it all the time. And it's facilitated by confidence. It has never been facilitated by arrogance, you know? I'm not sure exactly what a pure arrogant thought is. I know I've done it. I know I've had it in my mind. And sometimes I usually use arrogance as a funny technique, right? I'm going to go in and goof off in front of people and make them laugh or something like that, you know, or I'm going to imitate something like, hey, do that thing you do. And that's when I just let my Duke Nukem sort of personality come out, and it's all satire and fake, you know. But there are institutions that when you try to make a, let's say you have to teach society how to drive cars, okay? Very complex process, and people are different sizes inside vehicles. Vehicles are different sizes around the human beings. Some brakes are real sensitive. Some brakes are, you have to literally mash on them. Some cars are automatic. Some cars are standards. You know, there's all kinds of configurations. Some people have to be taught how to drive in the Midwest. Other people have to be taught how to drive in big cities. But there has to be a one-size-fits-all technique of teaching how to drive a car. So how the hell do we pull this off in society, right? No, we all know there's bad drivers who seemingly can't drive a straight line down a highway. But that's the same sort of mechanism that we have when we try to teach kids the difference between arrogance and confidence. And this is what I try to teach kids. Now, the number one rule I try to instill in my kids that I'm mentoring or what have you is, or employees, is to not lie to them about anything that they're capable of doing. So I'm not the kind of guy that comes in and says, oh, I'm looking at this person, I'm thinking, man, they really don't know what the hell they're doing. Their art's horrible, whatever. And I'm going to say, oh, well, you're so good, you know, just keep at it and walk off, right? That's what bad parenting does. That's what bad mentorship does. That's what a tired teacher does. You can't blame teachers because they've got like 35 students. To really sit down and mentor a person, it takes very one-on-one, you know, engagement, right? But you can do it subliminally, and you can do it right in their face. What I find out is that what I have found out is that if you come in and you compliment too quickly, even though you're telling the truth, you can run into a situation where the person listening to you doesn't believe you, because they're so certain about their inabilities that when you start talking about their abilities, you can't. You're gonna have to do a more kind of ground up technique. And it goes something like this. What if a person's struggling with a vision they have in their brain? Let's just to keep it simple, let's just say they're a painter. All right. And they have a vision in their brain of what the painting is supposed to look like, and they paint on canvas, and it doesn't look like what they think it should look like. But you walk in the room, and you're blown away. You're like, oh, my God. For whatever makes me feel good, that's making me feel good, you know? And so the person has brought you into their life or allowed you into their life, perhaps to help them reach the goal that's inside their brain. And so you have to figure out what's going right that they can acknowledge and what's going wrong that both of you can acknowledge. Basically, what's going wrong is what you have to acknowledge in yourself. They're already well aware of what's wrong in their take of things, right? My advice to getting someone to believe you, and again, this is not a technique of being disingenuous and getting someone to believe you. This is the technique to be genuine and getting someone to believe you, that you're genuine. And believe me, in this day and age, with so much fraud everywhere, every politician's corrupt, every celebrity's corrupt. I mean, everybody's corrupt around us. We just hear that constantly, right? We tend to be jaded first, and then, you know, you earn trust, you know. It, you know, obviously the younger a person is, they tend to trust first, and then they get bit, and then it's, you know, then they're jaded for the rest of their life, or they're doing their due diligence on you moving forward. And unfortunately, you'll bump into people where you have to waste your time proving to them that you're genuine because so many people have been douchebags ahead of time. And dealing with celebrities, I deal with this all the time, that they, you know, some celebrities shake it off. Every time someone treats them badly and screws them, they shake it off. And other times they just get further down into that rabbit hole of, I'm never going to trust another human being as long as I live. And so it's tough, you know, to get in there. And because sometimes you'll sense that people really, really need and want a friend. They need a mentor, a muse. Maybe they don't need a mentor because they're really good at what they do, but they just need someone to say, you know, this is what I'm seeing. Is this not what's happening here? Am I misunderstanding that you actually accomplished this part of the game? You know? And that's how I move in on kids who are trying to get somewhere, or even adults, right? Now, hopefully it goes without saying that if you're going to get in and critique something, you need to have a fair amount of expertise yourself. But even if you don't, you can come at it from a spectator sport and helpfully make sure that they understand. But the last thing an artist ever wants to hear is that you're a kind of person that likes everything. That to an artist means get out of the room. You know, it's great if you buy my stuff. It's great if you like what I do. But honestly, if you don't have a discerning bone in your body, if you're the person that loves every form of music, every form of art, you're just this super duper doped out happy person, which again is nothing wrong with that. But if you're that kind of person, then you can't contribute where an artist is trying to be a Picasso. Right? Because a Picasso literally went and said, I've done it all. I've done all the basic stuff. Before he got into cubism, the way that he twisted and turned it perfectly for himself, he was done with all the basics, all the low-hanging fruit. So if you were to walk in there and go, well, I love everything. Well, what are you working on? And then he shows you this crazy, you know, two eyes on one side of the head, and they're like, oh, I love it. And he's going to say, well, you know, why do you love it? Oh, I just do. Picasso's going to be like, please use that door over there because you don't understand what I'm doing here. You're just super happy about everything and anything that happens to you. And I'm an artist and I'm trying to pierce the consciousness of mankind to see the world in a different light, to increase critical thinking by making artwork require critical thinking to truly understand the depths of what was going on in my consciousness when I painted. One of the first things you can do when you're talking to someone is to ask them why they did what they did. Regardless of what it is, just say, well, like when I walk into a room with artists especially, even people like in, you know, my age, or even a little older, I'll walk in and I had a buddy of mine who was a painter. Like I mentioned him earlier in a few episodes back where he was painting some pretty hefty, some dark shit, you know, about animal rights and the fair treatment, the humane treatment of animals, both for food processing, you know, drug testing and all that kind of stuff. And he's a master painter, man, let me tell you. But when I started seeing his more cookie cutter still life stuff, which was really cool, he managed to figure out a still life situation with skulls and velvet and all this other stuff that was pretty neat, but it was really sort of a one trick pony. You know, maybe you do four your entire life and call that the skull and bones, you know, still life suite. But once he started showing me multiples, I was starting to ask him, you know, I wanted to get into his mindset, and I said, well, What is your obsession with the skulls? What does that mean to you? Is it some like H.R. Giger, who was constantly riddled with nightmares since he was a child, and he was shown a mummy when he was a kid, and it freaked him out hardcore, and his sister made fun of him, and so in order to overcome the fear of this mummy and then the concept of death being final for that guy, he constantly went to the museum and looked at that mummy over and over and over again as a child until he had no more fears of it. But we all see H.R. Giger's Necronomicon books and, you know, the way he's got, you know, giant paper clips through baby eyeballs, you know. The guy was demented by his experience. And he hated religion, so he went off and did a bunch of satanic stuff. The most amazing satanic art on planet Earth is H.R. Giger stuff. And I mean, it's... hate it all you want, but the dude's talents were insane, right? If there's any dude to sign a deal with the devil, it's H.R. Giger, man. But you get into somebody, and I know this is about loving yourself, but we're trying to get into almost the subatomic level of what you gain by having confidence. And if you find a kid that doesn't have confidence that you think should have confidence, you start to see the price that people pay for this guilt trip of not loving themselves. Right? Religion absolutely positively teaches you to not like yourself. You know? When the guy that's in charge of the whole story in the New Testament totally dug himself, right? He's like, dudes, you know, eat this bread, it's my body, drink of this wine that is my blood. I mean, I don't know how much more intensely narcissistic you can get than having everybody consume your body. There's no other way to solve the problem, of course, right? You have to be a cannibalistic ritual of eating human body and human flesh. Yes, it's a metaphor for spirit and body and dot, 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 dot. Let me tell you, there's better ways of convincing mankind to engage in the Creator than to slowly go every Sunday to engage in a symbolic cannibalistic ritual with communion. It's weird. But I will tell you to your face that I've had amazing spiritual experiences taking communion. It's weird. The metaphor of the bread for me was the big deal. I never really liked the drinking part, no matter if it's grape juice or wine. When I was a kid, it was wine. Then it turned into grape juice later on. But I never really understood that either, because Jesus could have left the water water. But for whatever reason, we had to drink wine back in Jesus's time. But now we know that the church will tell most of their followers, you'll go to hell if you drink a single drop in some cults of Christianity. It's like weird, right? But getting into this practice of helping others find their confidence, you know, you have to go in and find out what makes them tick. Why are they at the place that they're at, right? That's a horrible, horrible sentence. But why are they doing what they're doing? What's the decision-making process? Is this random? Is this Jackson Pollock throwing paint all over a canvas and then cutting it out with scissors and selling it by the square foot? You know, or is it a true artist who's going, man, I'm using every single bit of negative space and positive space. I'm using colors that work together and textures that work together. And that's my game. I'm making something no one's ever seen before. Confidence problems exist all the way to death. You know, there are people who are in their 80s that I've met in my lifetime that just have a humble nature of inequity. You know, they had parents that beat them up or were very verbally abusive to them, and they never were able to gain a confidence level that they could keep. And it's a shame. It hurts the soul, man, to see it happen when you know that they got everything that they need. And then you meet the kid who's got nothing, who's got arrogance falling out of their arteries, right? They bring nothing to society but cliche, trite repeats of other people's stuff, and they think they're killing it. And that's a lot of what's happening in the 21st century, is that, you know, we're living in an era now where kids want to be famous for doing nothing. And this was, I forgot the philosopher who really nailed that, but a guy actually came out and said, this is going to be the age of being famous. And not only being famous, but being famous for doing nothing. And that's what we're dealing with right now. You know, the musicians that are the top musicians for kids, and I don't mean all of them, but you know, a lot of them are auto-tuned. Well, it means you really can't sing. You have an image, but again, the person will say, don't love yourself too much in front of me, right? Again, waving this cigar around is supposedly making someone feel insecure about themselves. It's like, dude, get some therapy, man. Seriously. But if, you know, your favorite action hero on the big screen you know, walks in and, you know, says, I'll be back, that's totally cool. You'll just have goosebumps running up and down your body, you know? Because in the mind of whoever's feeling that, and I feel that for people too, I dig it. I dig when people have their own personas, and especially when they're in front of the camera, they're acting. They're not really who they are, right? Now, I'm this dude. I'm the dude you're talking to right now. I do pull my hair up and take my sunglasses off, but then I would show you my alien eyes, and that'd be a little bit weird, right? But I do. I'm a normal dude, you know? I got a job, and I got friends, and we do what we do, right? I've met some of the listeners face-to-face. It's super cool, right? I do wish the world was a bit smaller and it's a bit easier to meet some of you guys, because some of you guys are across the pond, and I would just love to sit down and just talk forever, kick back a few 17% beers. But when I get in with these kids, or whomever I'm trying to help, right? And it could be that it's someone I'm just bouncing through a party, and then when I met this artist guy, I met him at a party, and he's like, well, how do you know so-and-so? Why are you here? And I was like, oh, well, I'm dating her, and she works at this place, and so that's how I'm here. And he, well, what do you do? Oh, God, you know, I've done everything. I'm running my video game company right now, but I used to be this. And he was like, oh, my God, me, you know, I'm into art, too, and let me show you my iPhone what I do. Boom, 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 boom. And, you know, usually you're either talking to someone who's totally made it. You know, I have a gallery down in Laguna. My name's Vladimir Kush, and I kick ass and take names left and right. Okay. You're talking about the guy who hasn't made it yet. You know, and I bumped into a ton of these dudes who have amazing talents, amazing ideas, and they're simply unable to get off the ground. And a lot of times when I meet them, I look at their friend circles around them, and they have these guys and these girls, which sort of are supportive, but with a limitation of, I'm only going to support you up to the point you start threatening me. Once you start threatening my self-image and my capabilities, I'm going to pull back my positive comments. And I see this all the time as well, you know? And some people have great support circles who help them out and sacrifice their souls for these individuals, and they still aren't able to quite make it happen. For whatever reason, maybe they're ahead of their time, or they just simply can't get the eyeballs to look at what they do. But what I do is I get into the bowels of what they're doing. If I'm looking at art, I want to look at the brush strokes. I want to look at how they hold the brush. I want to look at composition. I want to look at contrast mapping. I want to look at everything. Where are they getting their ideas? What is the true meaning behind a particular painting? Right? I got a relative who is a painter, and he's sort of a distant relative. Nice guy. But he was painting these pretty cool paintings, but then he'd paint words all over the canvas, which was the meaning of his painting. I was like, well, that's unique, it's unique. You would paint the words on your canvas, because every art teacher I've ever talked to is you're supposed to give that feeling to the viewer without actually undermining the opportunity for them to have more of an impact than what your words are going to say. Because words are very limiting, right? Words put up borders in the mind, and words mean different things to different people, no matter how you slice it, right? So, you know, the advice I wanted to give him was, how about you paint the exact sort of thing, but just don't put any words on it, and let that be the mystery of what the hell does this painting mean? Because he beautifully, I think at least at a minimum level, did achieve the message he was painting on the canvas. And so how would it be, you know, how cool would it be to look at this, and you have this gestalt-y feeling of exactly what he meant, and then you read the plaque on the wall, and you're like, oh yeah, that's it. That's totally what I was thinking. Different words than I would have used, but that's definitely where I was at, you know? But we all know that going to school as a child is rough. Growing up as a child is rough. No matter where you are, no matter how utopian your little city is, it's tough. And if you live in a big city, it's really tough, right? So the one thing that a child could use as a mechanism for getting through those tough times, and people are going to be brutal to them simply because their name sounds funny. Maybe they have a certain weird look, you know? They need some extra footing, some extra bedding, some extra confidence that's outside the perspective of someone judging them, you know? I have several beautiful aunts, and I'll just say this much. I have three aunts on one side of my family, and they're all gorgeous, and they were gorgeous when they were young. But two of them, the two oldest ones, got a lot of accolades in school for being beautiful. And it sort of intimidated the living crap out of the youngest one, who was actually a fair distance away in age from their Herdex sister up. So they didn't really share the same hallways in school, right? Because high school used to be three grades when I was a kid, 10th through 11th, right? But now every single adult that knew my youngest aunt was looking at her and saying, kid, you're beautiful. You're young is why that you're having an issue with your perception of being sort of what you would portray perhaps as an ugly duckling. You know, the ugly duckling stories, obviously, it was looked like a weird little duck. And when it grew up, it became this beautiful swan. It was gorgeous, right? And sure enough, my youngest aunt, just grew up just as gorgeous as my other two aunts and looks fantastic to this day. But she went through this little jaunt. This is the stuff you get to see when you grow up in a little town, right? And, you know, if you have a family of a certain size and you pay attention to what's going on and you have good intellectual conversations as a child with your parents and your surrounding adults, I got to watch her go from having very little confidence to having amazing levels of confidence, qualified confidence, right? Not arrogance, all right? And it doesn't mean she was perfect, but she got there in her mind. But she struggled all the way through her childhood because I think that back in the 70s, in 80s, when she was growing up and going through this kind of tumultuous stage of her self-perception, the family was Catholic. You know, my family was Catholic. And I actually misquoted in an episode. It was my mother's father's family that brought a bunch of churches into the Midwest, as I understand it, not my father's parents. I know that a lot of you cared about that distinction there. But if you look up low family and you're trying to find Catholic churches, you're not going to find them. But anyway, I think that no one had the confidence or I should say even the wherewithal to approach this kid and say, hey, don't you worry. Don't you worry. You're going to, you know, one, you look beautiful right now, but I assure you by the time you hit high school and above, you're going to be a little heartthrob yourself. And that feedback loop of whether or not you look in the mirror and like yourself is going to be erased. And you know, I think fortunately it did resolve, but unfortunately it didn't resolve fast enough because there's too many people around here saying, don't love yourself. You know, and it's, again, it's exuded from parents and grandparents. Either, you know, when a parent or a grandparent's unhappy, the kid can't really get a sense that you like yourself, even though you might, you know. But a person that doesn't like themselves gets really, one, they should like themselves. You know, I bumped into guys, you know, it's funny, in Southern California, it's a really different environment than any other place I've been in the planet Earth. When I went to the Bay Area, for instance, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of race mixing, so you have a lot of really unique looking people. They don't look like people in magazines, and they get nervous that they don't look like people in magazines and people on TV. And in my opinion, they look more interesting because they're achieving their beauty or their handsomeness in a way that is unique. And so like, hey man, you look great, but you don't look like all these cookie cutter people. And why would you want to? You're actually super unique. Look at Mick Jagger, for God's sakes. You know, look at Steven Tyler, lead singer of Aerosmith. Now these guys are if you, when I saw Mick Jagger as a kid, I remember thinking, God, how unfortunately ugly is that dude? And as I got older, I was like, oh, I get it. He's totally unique, and he doesn't look like anybody else, and he's got a manly vibe to him, even though he does that turkey dance thing he does. But, you know, and he's obviously massively talented, so he would be able to find women no matter what. But I really think in the end, I thought, man, you really are cool looking. You have a totally cool look that's all your own, right? People say if they happen to have the same gene strand that Mick Jagger has, no matter if they're older than Mick or younger than Mick, most human beings would say, that looks like me. He looks like Mick Jagger. You're like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because Mick Jagger's made his look cool. Now, the reason why I mention that is that in Southern California, there's a difference between Northern California when it comes to the confidence that I experienced when I was up there. People in the Bay Area were sort of on edge a lot, and there was a lot of dog-eat-dog behavior. One, because a lot of people in the Bay Area aren't from the Bay Area. They migrated from other states of America to get into Silicon Valley. So they're already sort of scared of, you know, not being able to get a job, not being able to keep the job. And so it's sort of like, can I keep you down, step on your head to get ahead? I saw a lot of that when I went up there. Southern California is the complete opposite. It's, can I network you into a better position? Because I'm going to value myself and I put my head down on the pillow at night. I help person A or B meet person C and D and look at their career blow up. You know, I watched a movie the other day, Trainwreck, with Amy Schumer. And I'm watching this movie with my girlfriend, and two of the comedians on the show were, one was in a pilot I filmed with some guys up in Hollywood in 2003, and another one is a client of mine who's a pretty intense writer for Saturday Night Live, an amazing actress in herself, amazing stand-up comedian. And I was like, wow, these are some of my clients and some of the people I've worked with in the past, and that was kind of cool, right? It made it seem like, so in Southern California, it would make me seem like, oh, you have some connections. Hey, maybe we should get you connected with one person or another. Maybe you can help my friend who's looking for that same kind of opening, right? In Northern Cal, my experience would be, oh, you think you're all that because you know these people. It's kind of weird, right? Strange. But loving yourself is imperative, man. You've got to be able to look in that mirror and love yourself and do whatever you need to do to get to that point. But no matter what you look like, no matter who you are as a human being, I'm hoping that, you know, if you're watching this show, you're all into self-improvement. You're all into like living every second of your life. If anything consumes your time and isn't related to either, you know, the food groups of living, right? Being being productive, but also being relaxing, you know? If you're a parent, you got to be a parent. And hopefully that's fun. Hopefully being a parent's cool and fun. And hopefully this kind of conversation will give you some to-dos with your kids that are fun, right? But what I do with people, and I know I'm meandering around a little bit, here a little bit, is I get in and I use my background, which is to say I know what's hard in a lot of these things that people get into. And I typically don't make comments in things that I don't know, but if I do have to make a comment in something I don't understand, I'll simply say the following. I'll say, well, I don't know about how to do that. But I'll tell you what, it looks really difficult. You know, it looks really formidable and scary what you're doing. And so I'm impressed, just so you know. And, you know, and if they're looking at you, once you start saying compliments, like they start to look at you, and the next thing you need to say is, I mean, hopefully it's true for you, is to say, I don't like everything. You know, for you to, one thing I tell my friends is, if you make me laugh out loud, you are a funny dude or a funny chick. And typically, if anybody has a consistent ability to make me laugh out loud, I do whatever I can to keep them in my life. Because just right away, what I think is, wow, you have an eclectic brain like mine that you can hit me left and right. And believe me, I laugh at the stupid stuff too. But I feel like, you know, I've studied comedy so much and I was raised on comedies that I feel like it's just got to be funny. I mean, to me, you know, obviously it's subjective to me. But for instance, someone like my father recommended I watch this movie, Ridiculous Six, which is Adam Sandler's attempt to, I guess, make a Blazing Saddles. It was the most atrocious film I'd ever seen. I mean, the character dimensions were horrible. I asked my daughter, I said, why is this so funny? Because she thought it was funny. She goes, oh, we don't know, that guy's from Twilight, the movie, and he's acting really stupid in this film. So him acting stupid is funny to me because we've always seen him in these serious Twilight episodes. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. So it's a generational comedy for you, just like Blazing Saddles was a generational comedy to me. And it helped me understand things. It made me pleased that there was a demographic that was getting into this, right? Just wasn't for me, right? But what is arrogance then? We all know what confidence is, and there's a million ways to build up confidence. What's arrogance? What is that? Well, I think arrogance is actually a fairly complex thing. You might think, well, a person thinks that they are something that they're not. They are portraying themselves as something way beyond what they really are. And so they shouldn't do that because that's a bad thing. Arrogance tends to lead to bad behavior, right? If you're arrogant, you'll walk around sort of in this condescending personality where you're sort of knocking people down verbally to prop yourself up. I think that's a fairly decent definition of one flavor of arrogance, right? And that's where you start to offend people or frustrate them with your existence. And someone, you know, usually when we talk about arrogance, we say about that individual behind their back, we'll say, well, that person really thinks they're you know, all that, right? Now, there's some fine lines in that we need to tolerate, and fine lines that are certainly we would prefer, okay, to go back to confidence. One of the points I always make to my friends in SoCal or even to my NorCal friends about SoCal experiences. When I used to go to Venice Beach a lot before it got really kind of changed and screwed up, there's a lot of performers in Venice Beach. Okay, so you come real early and you squat a certain space in Venice Beach and you perform on that square. And it used to be that you could just squat the best region that matched your performance needs. And now you have to go buy a lottery. I think you actually have to pay for it, but you get this lottery ticket about what space you can have. And so it's a person who needs a 25 by 25 foot square gets a 10 foot square, and they can't do their bit. Well, the guy that only needs 10 feet gets the gigantic slot. It's really sad the way they got it worked out now. At least that's the last I heard of it. I used to work with a lot of performers down there before they became stage performers. A lot of people came here and started in Venice Beach. Even Jamie Foxx started on Venice Beach, and he could never conquer it. And he was very elaborate with his setup there. But anyway, while at Venice Beach, what you'll notice in the middle of the summertime, if you've never been, definitely do it. And you probably have some regions in your area that are like this. But you'll go there and you'll have someone who is, for instance, my favorite experience, and this is where it really registered with me, was that I saw a girl who was very overweight. And I don't mean massively obese, but definitely that's sort of like you're almost massively obese. And she was wearing this bikini. And this thing was struggling for dear life to hang on to her body. But now here's the thing. She walked around that beach with a level of confidence that just exuded off of her. I didn't have a conversation with her. She wasn't being overtly, you know, conversational with everybody. But she had her friends, and I watched her with her friends. And I think they were making some comments about some really, you know, ripped guys down there, because there's always dudes down there that are, you know, working on the weight pile or whatever. And she made a few comments in front of me and walked off. And I remember thinking, one, I was totally attracted to this girl. And I thought, my God, you know, from if someone just took a photograph of this person and said, you know, you have a choice between this perceivably fit person and this heavy person, I would probably pick the fit person. You know, I just have not had a lot of experiences with people who are really heavy. But after I saw this woman exude her confidence down the beach, I thought, there's this little sidewalk that they have, right? Most people have seen on TV. I thought, oh my God, that girl is sexy as hell. With just her confidence, right? She looks like an interesting, fun person to be with. And she looks like she knows who she is. It looks like she knows that she's heavy. And it looks like she doesn't let it bother her, you know? And most of us would wish as much health on people as we possibly can. But again, being thin doesn't mean you're healthy. And being fat doesn't mean you're unhealthy. Some people are just built to be bigger. And they can carry it really, really well, you know? So for me, it's always been, who are you? Always, 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 you know? I've dated women, I really haven't dated anyone that's unattractive, but by my eyeballs, of course, but some of the ones that were probably less on a scale of 1 to 10 were some of the more interesting people I've ever dated in my life, you know? And so it's because of their confidence in who they were, their love for themselves that made me attracted to them, you know? Prince, the artist formerly known as Prince, or I guess he's Prince now, sorry. He used to tell a story when he finally kind of got into his 40s. He started kind of revealing part of his life, right? He's a very private dude, almost never gave any interviews, still almost never does any interviews. Always looks super duper tight, right? The guy's never shown up on camera not looking just immaculate. Has all of his clothes custom created for him, all that kind of stuff. All right. Well, he revealed a secret in his 40s, which was sort of like the secret, sort of like what the bleep do we know, which is the following. He said, look, I was nobody. I was a 5'3" black kid in Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he said, you know, he had a stepbrother who was super duper handsome guy. Andre Simone is what he ended up calling himself. I think his real name was Andre Jackson. I think that was his name, I think. But he said he was surrounded by all these guys that were getting all the women because they were perceivably matching the guys in the magazines. And so he said, I knew I had to get a bunch of talent to sort of get people to pay attention to me. Now, some people call that the Napoleon disease, you know, the whole overachieving thing. Well, you know, there are Napoleon people, and they get into that greed category where they just simply can't stop acquiring things because they never turn off their Napoleon complex. But if you find yourself in what you think is a disadvantage in life, you're going to have to pull off some tricks. And confidence is going to be your number one mechanism to erase the problem that you're having. But you're going to potentially run into arrogance as well. And you're going to have to temper that, of course, right? But here's what he did. This is sort of the thing that Tony Robbins teaches as well. He said, I simply painted a future, or I made a persona that was, I was what I wanted to be. He goes, I walked around like I had already succeeded. I walked around like I was a megastar. And he goes, it helped me practice. It helped me have the system to continually, just get better at what he did, practice, right, and perform. But he also knew that when he got on stage, people want to see people be confident. You know, when I took acting classes from this amazing actor, Dr. Gray, first time he had me come up on stage with this other dude, and we had to do an improv. And the improv was that we're standing in front of those cork boards at the college, and you know, it's a fourth wall, so nothing's really there. So we're staring at the audience, and we're supposed to make some small talk about some topic about the cards that are up there and jobs that are available and stuff. And I got up there, and he didn't give us any direction because he wanted us to fail first. And I was always the first one to volunteer, so I went up there, and I was fiddling with my hands. I had my hands in my pocket, you know, and in the end, what I looked like was silly. I looked like I was completely nervous to be up there. And by me being on stage, being nervous and acting nervous and fidgeting with my hands and fingers and everything, I made the audience feel that way too. And the audience does not want to feel that way. The audience wants to feel confidence. They want to feel like you are who you are. You want to portray the character properly, right? Well, you're not going to be able to do that if you've been beaten down by these people who say, you know, be the minimum that you can be, right? Don't ever get any confidence. Don't get this, this persona of yourself developed, right? I take it on the chin for having long hair, right? It's just so bizarre that people still judge books by covers. You know, I've had one comment that went out that the dude was like, giving me shit for looking like Cobain, I think. And it was probably one of my favorite compliments and comments because he said, you know, I judged you by the cover. And after I listened to this video, and I can't remember which one he watched, I think it was maybe the Moon episode or something like that. He said, I realized you did your research and I take it all back. And I thought, I'm not really trying to do that to anybody. I'm not trying to make people judge me and then they, he was actually a cool dude. But when it happens, it's interesting to me. Right. And we all do it, you know. There's the old saying that they love the sound of their own voice. And I definitely could say when I started making these episodes with Kyle, I couldn't stand the sound of my own voice. And, you know, through figuring out how to do this mic better and that kind of stuff, I finally became comfortable with my voice. I was like, okay. And people were saying, I love your voice and blah, 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 really soothing. And one guy was like a girl, I have no idea. Like, I use your videos just to go to sleep at night. I just put it on. It doesn't even matter what you're saying. Just that solid tone. And I was like, what I wanted to tell that person was, yeah, you know, I've put many girlfriends to sleep too, just talking to them, right? But you have to experiment to find out what you're good at. And what Prince was trying to tell us was like, you gotta build the future that you want to have happen to you. And you may decide at the end you don't want it. Prince wrote a song called Let It Go. And if you listen to the extended version, it's really, really amazing. But his whole thing was that he was uptight his whole life, trying to keep all the rules in check and try to live by this certain code. And I guess he had a little bout with alcohol in the 90s. But he eventually said, I'm just going to let it go and just going to be myself. I'm going to stop trying to be this persona that I've created or trying to reinvent myself every single year to be a different human being. Because he did. He changed his looks. He changed his whole sound. Every album is completely different. Go listen to Purple Rain, then Around the World in a Day, and then Parade. Those three albums in a row are utter opposites of each other, you know? But just think about it. If I tell you right now in this video, I want you to love yourself. I'm willing to bet half of you, if not more than half of you, will get a nervous feeling inside because you might feel like, well, that's scary. I might take it too far. And I don't want to be those people that I run into that I can't stand myself who've taken it too far. And I think what you all have to know is that we're all human beings just trying to make it on this planet. We're all trying to succeed. We're all trying to build up our friendships and our families. And you'll find that the people that are being extremely arrogant usually within themselves are very, well, there's some that we know that aren't what I'm about to say, but a lot of people are overachieving because inside they don't have the confidence that they exude, you know, the arrogance, the confidence the confidence without a really backing can be construed as arrogance, right? And you lose your friendships because you put yourself out there in a way that you can't deliver. You know, I see kids all the time in colleges and they're just walking around the streets. And I can tell by their walk, by the way they hold their head, that they don't have confidence. And it kills me, man. Every time I see that, it's almost like wanting to rescue a homeless person. You know, you want to get out there and go, all right, kid, let's just have a conversation. What turns you on, man? What makes you tick? What do you like in life? You know, and you take the things that that they do, which are usually very normal things, and you just go, me too. Me too. I love that. Isn't that awesome? You know, one of the things I used to do or I do when I get employees is that I come in looking. I've only had long hair since 2007. So I had long hair within my own personal company, but not at any other company I work for. And so I had the short hair thing, you know, I like okay with short hair. But I would go in and I sort of had, you know, I've always had a fair amount of money, so I was always able to look really tight. And, you know, I just didn't look like the geek nerd that spends his life in video game companies, but I was, right? I went home and I had higher level characters on most of the video games that my employees played. And it's not a competition. I'm just saying I invested in the same things that they loved. There's an old, and I'm just going to give you this example here so you can kind of understand maybe how to approach folks around you. But I just always did what was harmless to others that I really loved to do. And anything that expands my mind and my creativity, I was totally into. So when I was a young kid, I got to role play Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. Probably I was about 11 years old. And I absolutely loved it. And I wasn't able to play that game again until I was in my 20s. And being a writer, let me tell you right now, if you want to get your writing skills way, way up, role play with your buddies if you can. That game is absolutely brilliant. And kids are so bored of these choose-your-own-adventure movies or video games that when they get a chance to say, what happens? I do this. What happens? I do that. What happens? And your dungeon master, your game master is telling you what's going on. It's all dynamic, and it's based on your creativity of your actions. Believe me, it's fun. It's really fun, right? But I can tell you right now, the kids that role play walk around in usually a fear that they're going to bump into someone who's really cool. And when they're asked what they do to have fun, the last thing on the list they're going to admit to is playing Dungeons and Dragons because of the persona that's been attached to it, that it's a bunch of geeks, a bunch of Revenge of the Nerds guys, that society is, you know, again, in their own self-loathing way, they make fun of these kids for liking something that's completely harmless and actually good for their brain, right? So I would go in and talk to my employees, and I remember seeing their face, and I would come in, and I look like sort of an executive, the white-collar guy that would come in and talk to them, and they're expecting, they're being defensive about their pastimes because they don't want to let me know that they're a geek on the back end. Here we are at a video game company. How ridiculous is that? But there are plenty of executives that don't play video games that are in charge of video game companies, and that's why you see so many crappy games. That's why you see a lot of crappy movies, too. But when I would go into their cubes and I'd find paraphernalia in the cubes of the things that they loved, I would pull those things out very quickly in the conversation. And the more eclectic I could find an item, I would call it up. And, you know, there's all kinds of role-playing systems out there. And there's live-action role-playing, which is even more geeky in the eyes of those who do it. But when you start doing it, you start having a lot of fun, and you're like, I would never tell anybody I do this, right? Or there's people I wouldn't tell because they would judge me. They're not allowed to do what they love because they're fear being ostracized from the tribe. How nutty is that? But that's how we run life, right? We worry about what other people think about us. And that's where someone who is sort of in a self-loathing loop tries to attack others to get everybody in check to their self-loathing. Don't do anything cooler than me. Don't do anything more in-depth than me. be like me, because I have a confidence issue myself with you being something that maybe I want to be, you know. Now some people just hate cigars, so they're all up my butt about it. I understand. I watch people, and I've talked about it on the show a lot, people who usurp various behaviors as a rite of passage. You know, cigars are obviously a manly thing. You know, women don't smoke them much, and young kids usually don't smoke them much. There are women who smoke them, and there are young kids that get into it. But, you know, I don't think that I smoke cigars at all to be cool. I think I smoke cigars because it's a very unique thing. And the craftsmanship in these bad boys are just amazing, you know, like I've said in other things. I also don't try to exude anything that makes it matter, you know. Hopefully no one's ever felt that. And I'm not going to pander to a bunch of comments, just so you know. I'm going to make an episode about pandering. I was going to make one the other day, and I diverted for a different topic. But if somebody makes you feel nervous in yourself because of their behavior being successful, my suggestion is recognize the fact that almost unequivocally, you have something that they would love to be as well. You know, the whole thing about Mick Jagger looking funky, there's a lot of people in the world that, again, don't match magazines. And then they spend their whole life trying to match the magazines instead of just endorsing who they are. There are folks that are strung out on vices that damage their image of themselves. If someone's a comfort food person, right, they get to a point where they eat every time they have an emotional challenge in life, and therefore they get overweight, and they notice it. And they sort of don't believe that they can overcome their vice. And so they end up sort of persecuting those around them that are in shape. Even if it's like nobody works out, but, you know, they just didn't happen to gain that extra weight, or maybe their metabolism's still really fast, you know. I had a friend of mine that I was driving a car and taking everybody to lunch, and maybe had five people in the car. And this girl was in the passenger seat, very good friend of mine, wonderful person. And she just carried more weight. That was just her body type, and I would never assume that this woman would ever be like a girl in a magazine. But what she has in a full figured manner, I could see a girl who's really skinny envying her full figured body, you know. And you know, this is full figured without any fat, you know, half the time. But the guy in the back was definitely not one of these people. That he's a bigger guy, but he shouldn't be heavy. And he had probably he's probably about 80 pounds overweight when I met him. And he went off and he read the book Skinny Bitch, and he left the vegan portion of the book behind, but he went ahead and started changing his diet, and he lost 75 pounds. And before, right when we got in this car, he had hit the 75-pound mark, and he was a dude that we didn't see very often because he sort of was out of town most of the time, but we talked to him through email and stuff. Well, he is in the back of the car, and he is celebrating the fact that this system worked for him. And it got to the end of the conversation, and the girl in the front seat turned around and said, "Well, it's hard." And I forgot exactly what he said before that. He wasn't making fun of anybody that was heavy, because he was heavy, and he still needed to lose probably 20 more pounds or whatever on his goal. And she took it personal. And everything that was his success became her failure. And she was offended by that situation. And another conversation, probably one of the last times I ever saw this woman, we're at the table and we're talking about, someone was talking about their ex-wife and how they were arguing over how to raise a child. And it was some definitively bad decisions this ex-wife was making. And it's hard to raise kids, so I don't think anybody was in a major judgment stage, but we're talking about it. And this person leaps into the conversation and says, "Well, you have no idea what it's like to be a single mom," blah, 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 and just was utterly defending this person in the middle of a person's need to vent about some bad decisions that were being made for their child. And at that point, we sort of stopped communicating with her, and we stopped inviting her to the circle, because it was like, man, everyone else's problems are your problems all of a sudden. You're always a victim of anything that's going on in the conversation. And there was obviously some unhappiness within this person. She was unhappy about her weight. She was unhappy about perhaps some decisions that she had made as a mother. She was a single mother as well. And we thought, instead of being constructive to the conversation, it became a defense mechanism. There was nothing we could do to really engage her because she was sort of always just this nerve that was always easily rubbed the wrong way. And none of us were. And consequently, this person was from the Bay Area and had moved to Southern California and was trying to coexist with a bunch of Southern California people that just want to find solutions to life, right? We're not into persecuting people, not around people watching to put everybody down. We're just trying to make sure that, if we see something that's happening in someone else's life that we do ourselves, that we all need to fix, we'd have a conversation about it. And say, that is really tough, isn't it? All of us have gained, if you're over 40, there's usually a point in your life where you've gained more weight than you wanted. Maybe you still have the pounds, you know. I can tell that I've put on probably 10 pounds I need to lose from summer because it became so cold out. My regiment's working out here on this patio, and it's really tough at 40 degrees, you know. But we absolutely have to maintain techniques of loving ourselves, and it can never be made a demonistic behavior. We just have to check ourselves when it comes to confidence. That's all, you know. We can't allow ourselves to cross over into arrogance unless it's being used very strategically. And what I like to tell people is you can live your life a couple different ways, and both ways are just fine. You can have the way you are at home with your closest loved ones and that sort of thing, and you can have the way that you are when you go out in public. Now, every single one of us does this, right? A lot of times people will... get into the modern way of communicating where you might use a bunch of cuss words. You might use a bunch of, watching a funny comedy that's pretty seedy, R-rated comedy, and they're making jokes that are inappropriate for, say, your grandparents. And then you go talk to your grandparents or some other older person, and they come from the more controlled world where there was more behavior or more, more behavior and not cussing or anything. Like, you just didn't do it in public. And you will change the way you communicate with those people. Okay, well, we all do that. When I stayed with my dad at his house, I mean, geez, we could say anything we wanted to. Fouled everything. One, that got that stuff out of my system young. So when I grew up, I was like, those are all old jokes. Don't need to tell them anymore. But two, my grandmother, when she came over, she kept me in check. Because I had to practice being a good person. You know, I had to practice not saying dirty words. I had to practice not thinking ridiculous thoughts to be funny, you know? If you're a boy, you know, there's always that era in your life, depending on where you come from. I envy those of you who didn't run into this problem, because I definitely did, where I had some friends and family members and that really went for, like, the most inappropriate comments on everything, right? And it's funny, you know, it is funny from time to time, but there's a point where you should grow out of it, I think, and I've got family members that have never grown out of it, which is unfortunate. But it's just like those of us who drink a lot when we were young. In high school, I got to a point where I actually drank a lot, and I got pukey sick a lot, and a lot of hangovers, and I was like, man, I am done with this. I will drink from time to time, but it'll be purely out of a minor recreation to get to a tipsy level, and then I'm going to pull back, and I'll do that early in the evening, and then drink away with water all my tipsiness, and when I get in the car, I'm totally legal and fine. So I know you guys feel me on this. I know it's just a tough one to do that driver's training on, right? One size fits all training on how not to be arrogant. I've been in situations in my life where I've been in really dangerous neighborhoods. I definitely was perceived within those neighborhoods as being a have, whether it be the car I drove up in or the clothes I'm wearing. But the one reason why I've never had anyone step to me and really get in my face is because I act respectful to all those around me to the best of my ability, right? I don't exude an arrogance of any kind because I don't really try to feed my ego anything, right? You know, I've dated some incredible people who have never hung out with nerds in their life. And usually within a few months of a relationship with me, they'll find out I have a nice nerd quality to me. If nothing else, just the subject matters we talk about on Deep Thoughts are usually perceived as a nerdy intellect to discuss these things, which I think is sort of unfortunate. But I think that most of you who watch this, especially if you made it to an hour plus of this podcast or this video, you definitely know this feeling as well. But what ends up happening in these people that I date is that they get to the point where they're like, oh, you know, this is really a good quality category of human beings on planet Earth, right? The movie Revenge of the Nerds was really funny because it took the jocks and it put them up against the nerds. And in the end, the nerds got all the beautiful women, right? Which is obviously a nice fantasy for everybody who's a nerd like myself. But, you know, I was born with a look that doesn't easily fall into the nerd category. All right, that's just luck of the draw. I didn't choose my parents. You know, it just happened. And so when I would get into like role-playing circles with people and you come in, you sit down and everyone gets a little nervous. Who's this guy? He doesn't look like one of us, you know. He actually combed his hair this morning. As soon as I start behaving like a peer and I start I'm one of them, man. I am in there and they're just as creative as me, if not 10 times as creative as I am. And they start to feel like, oh, he's treating us as an equal. If not treating us like we're the experts and he's the novice, which is usually the case, as soon as they find out that that's the kind of personality you are, there's nothing they won't do for you. A nerd is your best friend on planet Earth, because usually they haven't had the opportunity to be arrogant and become flamboyant and step on people's heads to get ahead. It usually doesn't happen, you know? There was a kid on the internet. I'm sure he's still there. He's a cute kid who, there's this, I'll give an example of a nerd kind of going off the deep end in a really cute way. There's this kid out there that does videos for how to make Arduino inventions. And for those of you who don't know what Arduino is, it's a little tiny circuit. The Raspberry Pi is the one that they built in the UK. And you attach things to it. And it's just like Legos with a brain in it. You could program these things in what's called skits. And you can build robots. You could do anything with an Arduino circuit. It's amazing. They're $40 for the circuit, and you probably need about $100 of other, you know, wires and resistors and LEDs to really make it go. You can buy little robot kits with wheels and stuff, and it's a total nerd fest thing. It's awesome, right? Plus, you learn electronics big time, and you learn programming scripts. And a lot of kids have made amazing inventions with these things that'll probably be part of our future, right? But this kid was making invention after invention, really neat stuff, and he's making videos about himself because he was going through college. And so everything that he learned, he made a video. And he got a pretty good following. And as I was trying to learn the Arduino, because I was programming this hat that had LEDs in it, I had to do some microcontroller programming, I was learning from this kid. And the funny thing was is that every video started out with who he was and sort of this boilerplate introduction of sort of how amazing he is at this, right? And I don't think he was realizing that he was really pumping himself up at the beginning. Hey, no problem, right? It's his choice. But by the time he graduated, I think, with honors and probably was going after his PhD eventually on this thing. But he'd actually even written a book on this thing. And he, in the videos on YouTube, he really pumps the fact he's written these books. And he would like introduce himself by saying, these are all the amazing things that I've done. And he wouldn't do a video unless he recapped everything he'd done since the previous video. And he was very humble, but at the same time, he had that arrogance to him, you know. And you look at the kid and you're like, for me, I was like, you go, kid, man, you go. Because you will mature out of this, most likely. And you'll look back at these videos and you'll cringe a little bit about how you were pitching yourself. But in the end, it was an ends to a means, right? The kid probably grew up, he's very, very, I'm sure he's actually going to be a very handsome guy when he finally, you know, finds his look as an adult. We all have had those awkward looks, and he was in the middle of his awkward look. Because he was so technical at the time, right? Once he starts getting into girls and moving around, moving and shaking in society, I'm sure he'll tone down a little bit and find out what's more humble and interesting about himself. But I looked at the guy and I was like, well, this guy's definitely got a big love himself thing going on. He's definitely got the arrogance thing going on. I just thought, this is what he needed at that point in his life to make it. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think that, you know, if your kid doesn't have a minimum amount of confidence in themselves, the problem is that they will, they'll struggle way harder than they needed to, just to exist in society, just to integrate with society. And so I think that, I think I'm preaching to the choir, of course, but just think about it. When you think about someone saying, or you even saying to yourself, I love myself, just say it out loud when you're by yourself, I love myself. See if you don't have a little tinge of guilt because the way society's programmed you to grovel, to be the meek that inherits the earth. All I got to say is fuck that. There's your F-bomb for this video. Screw that. You know, be all that you can be. Be confident in what you can do. You know, if, you know, arrogance is you playing with a fake persona of your confidence. You know when you're causing yourself problems with arrogance, I think. And for those who don't, well, society will automatically reject them anyway. And so they'll have to self-correct or they'll be one of the loneliest people on planet Earth. You know, when I worked at Electronic Arts, one of the things I like to tell people was our local branch, I think, had about 1,500 people before the internet joined, which I think had another 1,000 or so, 3,500 globally. And EA was much bigger than that globally. But I always try to tell people, I said, at EA, the most talented, amazing people on planet Earth were the most humble people on planet Earth. And there was only a few guys in the entire company that exuded arrogance. They were known for it, and they were not celebrated for it. Because everyone in the company knew that no matter how talented you think you are, there's someone more talented than you right around the corner. And that was the truth. And I can definitely say those who did run around with that arrogance have since humbled down quite a bit. Because the, you know, when you're in your 20s in the video game business, if you're really hot commodity and you have a lot of good skills, and depending on what you do, it doesn't matter, you will make a lot of money very, very quickly, typically, if you play your cards right. But then when you enter your 30s, there's going to be a boom and bust that's going to kick you out of your job, most likely. And you'll be humble again. Because all that, all those moments of arrogance that, that supposedly fed your success will no longer matter, you know? I was always told about major league sports, that or professional sports, is that if you were a big college sports person, whatever sport you played, and all your little tricks of the trade blew the minds of all your peers that played with you, either from opposing teams or the team that you came from, once you entered professional sports, none of your tricks work anymore. Very few of them work anymore. And so it was humble pie for you as soon as you got in, because you're with the world's best players on planet Earth. That changes the game. So, you know, if you think someone's in a dangerous level of confidence, or I should say even arrogance, which spills over into arrogance, you can try to take time out of your life to change them, but I guarantee you society will self-regulate that human being, you know? I think I'll just stop right there. You guys know what I'm talking about. This is one of the looser episodes, but I think it's something worth talking about. If you haven't been already, go to mkultraradio.com. It's the way to get to all the arteries. You know the game. I want you to love yourself. Love somebody else. How's that? Change the script a little, huh? I'm so clever. I think I'll be arrogant about that cleverness right now. All right. I'll see you in the next episode. Live well in the meantime. Talk to you later. Over now. I'm a ninja. Yo, my life is like a video game. My main thing when I'm in the zone. One player, one life in the mark. I'm with a dog. Go, ninja. Go. No fucking it down, I'm cutting down anyone in my path. Trying to fuck up my game with razor sharp political throw stars. Tear my flows on hostile, wild, out of control. Ninja scope for fuck the roof. Dial, rough rounds and tough times. Red fuck all course, scrawl. Till I hit 777 at the ATM. Straight famine of feast. When you're living on the razor edge. Stay sharp, sharp, rolling with the S.O.S.